Hey there, everybody. It is March 11th, 2015, and this is Weekly Manga Recap. The voice you are hearing is Chris Rolotilarios, which, assuming this isn't the first time you're listening to the podcast, is a bit strange to you, because normally it is Y Ruler of Time who introduced you to this podcast, but sadly, Nick is not able to join us this week, and it's only sad for us because we will not be able to take the great splendor that is Nicholas Freeman's voice and manga opinions. Instead, he is he's busy off having a great time with the camel that I bought him. All right, I was trying to keep it secret. I bought Nick a camel. It's the secret I was kept from him on Twitter, and he is having fun with that camel. I know he mentioned he doesn't like dogs, presumably because they're big and they're, you know, rude. But I think a camel solves all those problems by having all of them in even more excess than a dog would. So, you know, Nick will enjoy his camel this week, and then next week he'll come back and we'll have a regular episode. So, this is just a heads up. In case you're listening to this episode, I'm going to make this an official episode because it was better to have something up than nothing. In case you were just listening now and it's your first time, you can know full well there will be no Nick. This is just me riding solo. Sorry, I have to do that every time. This is just going to be me. And I'm going to be still doing the weekly manga recap as per usual. But understand, you know, maybe this won't be your deal. Maybe you might not like it being solo. In which case, I don't blame you at all if you just want to skip to next week's episode or hold off a week or whatnot. But I want to provide something rather than nothing. And that's what we're getting. So I have no one to ask how they're doing. And I really don't have anyone to go off on a random off-topic tangent with, aside from the fact that I'm crushing Infamous Planet in, like, six trivia games in a row. Like, and I mean I get a row, like, I mean he sent me, like, six trivia games, and I just crushed him in all of them. And I know he's not going to do a visual edition for this episode, because it's a solo episode, but I just want everybody to know I'm crushing him. Like, fucking 28-6. It's disgusting. I am absolutely just demolishing this kid. So, just, you know, I wanted to get that out there. But otherwise, that's let's get into the recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap. Starting this week, of course, with Bleach. Bleach chapter 618, The Dark Arm. And it's Bleach this week. Not Black Clover. Black Clover has finished its jumpstart run, and we'll find out, I guess, in a couple weeks if it's going to be staying in the magazine or anything else like that. But Bleach is now back to the starting position. And we open up with Shunsui talking with Aizen, picking up basically right where last week led off, with Aizen kind of repeating the phrase of, you know, you still have two more keys to use, why aren't you? So Shunsui says, okay, and he frees Aizen's left eye and ankles, which I don't quite understand, because he's walking there, and he has his left eye out. And from that, I'm guessing the illusion... I'm guessing this is an illusion of Aizen? Of some kind? I don't know what this is of Aizen. He's some kind of weird hypnosis thing, I guess, because Shunsui was surprised when he showed up last week. But I assume if he had to walk up, he had to have some use of his ankles. And I don't really get what having his ankles would really do for him. I mean, I guess hypnosis through, I don't know, it just seems weird. Anyways, Shunsui basically say, you know, asks him, like, hey, don't you want out of here? And he's like, well, I don't recall being asked to let out, you know, be let out. And Shunsui basically tells him, like, okay, you know what? Actually, no, sorry. First, Shunsui mentions that he buried the key to the Mukin prison in his heart. Like, Aizen picks up on that. He's like, ah, you know, you want me out, but you see you've gone as far as burying the key inside your body. And Shunsui admits that that was, I guess, the condition to releasing Aizen from the Central 46, whatever the fuck their name is, Central 46, that... Shunsui have the key literally buried into his heart so that if he's killed, the gates of the Mukin are forever closed, so Aizen can never get out at that point. So basically assuring that Aizen can't just kill Shunsui and then, you know, continue his rampage at the Soul Society. I'm not exactly sure how that works. Like, if someone kills Shunsui, couldn't they just, like, reach into his heart afterwards and pick the key out? I mean, it's not like when Shunsui dies, he, like, absorbs himself into a black hole of some kind. Plus, it seems really painful to insert a key in your heart. It's like reverse Iron Man. Yeah. Anyway, Shunsui asks, you know, hey, why don't you sit down in this chair and let us carry you to the surface? Don't you want to breathe the air up in the Soul Society? And one of the escorts comes up saying he has to restrain Aizen before he'll allow him to take a seat. And Aizen just... I don't know what Aizen exactly does. The guy's fingers just explode off, and Aizen was clearly the reason for it happening. Aizen explains that these restraints do not eliminate my spiritual pressure. They only keep it near me. I don't have to tell you what will happen if you try to touch me. Shunsui Kyogaku. I don't know why I was doing a bad James Earl Jones there, I guess. He says, even if I sat on that chair and left this place, do you think I would help the Soul Society? And Shunsui's like, well, golly gee there, Willikers, I'm not asking you to fight for the Soul Society. Just figured, you know, we have a mutual interest in not having reality fucking damn blasted blown up by that fucking mustache asshole. And Aizen's like, ah, I guess I do want to breathe the air. So, oh, and sorry, he has a full quote here. Do I want to breathe the air, you ask? The air of that pitiful Soul Society that is about to be crushed by Yuhabok. Kind of a weird line there. Alright, so, we then cut into the Ryoku, or the Ryoku, whatever the fucking Soul Palace. I forget the Japanese name for it. That's what Nick's usually here for. I don't remember that stuff. I don't remember anything in Bleach. And, Yuhabok's about to try to just destroy Ryo again. He's like, I'm gonna blow you away. And before he can do that, Ichigo knocks his hand away, blocks the attack, and, fuck, it's the only character whose name I didn't... Yorichi. I don't know, like, it was, like, the one character who I actually know from this series for a long time. Yorichi runs up to Ryo and, uses a, uses some kind of Kido, or some kind of spell at least, to basically form a protective prison around Ryo. And, she notes that we'll, you know, they need to preserve him like this is the new Soul Society king. And we cut back to Ichigo and Yuhabok. And he's like, well, Ichigo, why are you trying to stop me? It was you who slayed Ryo. The Quincy blood in you should not tolerate Ryo's existence. You should have no reason to stop me. And Ichigo goes into this big speech about, I came here to stop you. I came here to protect the Soul Society, the living world, Hueco Mundo, to protect it all. Protect it all? The arrogance! You think nobody but you can do that? He's like, no, I mean, that's not what my speech was about at all. I never said anything about it having to be me, but, I mean, even to that point, like, even if someone else could, that's not a reason for me not to. I mean, his speech is, like, a lot more passionate, but that's, like, what I added on to it, because I was like, it's really weird that Yuhabok was like, why is this about you? And Ichigo's like, I really didn't make it about me. I mean, yes, I used, you know, the term, I came here to do this and that, but it's really not about that. I feel like you're kind of imposing some of your own feelings on this. Laser blast sword thing. And he uses his laser blast sword thing. I think there's a sound effect for it, but I can't tell what it's supposed to be. Oh, wait, hold on. It's, dum. That was underwhelming. It's so huge, I'd expect something more impactful than dum. But anyway, Ichigo continues, Yuhabok, you told me that I have your blood in me. But so what? That's not gonna make me do what you want me to do. Except it kinda did at one point. And Yuhabok responds, I can't make you do what I want! Don't make me laugh there, boy! Whether or not you'll do as I wish is up to this. I am mine. And, that's Bleach this week. This was not a bad chapter, per se. The Aizen stuff, again, I'm super excited Aizen's back, because I know he's just gonna be a monumental headache everywhere he goes, and he's already starting with it. I do not get the whole, like, I'm gonna free your left eye and your ankles thing. I'm sure somebody with more Bleach knowledge could grasp exactly why that's happening. I don't have that, unfortunately, so for me, I was just like, huh, well, that seems strange, but I guess then. And then the speech with Yuhabok and Ichigo. And I like this for the sense that we have not had Ichigo being like the hero of this series in a long time. He has not been the main character. He has not been the guy like fighting up against the main villain. He has not been the guy making these big impassioned speeches for years. For years we haven't had that side of Ichigo. So having him be this guy staying up to Yubak and having this big speech about how he's come here to protect everybody, I like that. I dig that as an aspect of the series, kind of coming back. We're finally actually getting to see our protagonist being the protagonist of the series. It's weird that all of a sudden it feels like Bleach might suddenly wrap up, but I keep reminding myself that there's still aspects of the story that just have not been utilized yet. You know, we still have not, and I know we joke about it, but I'm like, we still haven't seen what Tsukishima and Genjo and those guys are going to do. We still haven't seen Grimmjow. I assume Kenpachi still is going to have a bigger role in all this, because they mentioned him as being one of like the five factors in this war. You know, there's still the four elite guards going on, but right now this feels like we're digging into it, like we're getting closer, like Ichigo and Yubak are finally squaring off, and presumably these are going to be the two final opponents, unless Ichigo has to fight Aizen again, which, oh sweet Jesus God, no, that'll be hilariously awesome, awful. But it's just nice to kind of see Ichigo back in the role of being the, you know, the lead, you know? It's been a while since we've actually gotten to enjoy that, so. I suppose in that sense, I enjoyed Bleach this week. It's not like this is a great chapter or anything like that. But it was fine. It worked for me, you know? It has its ups and downs, but ultimately, it was a fun chapter. So, let's move on to Cyborg Rogi. Or is it Rogi? I'm calling Rogi. Chapter 3, Parts and Original. So we open up with Rogi visiting Dog at his job as a... I guess he's a... I don't think a porn salesman, but like I guess a guy who works at like a movie store that has dirty movies. I don't know. Anyway, there's this guy with a really furry head who... Rogi jokes, he's like, is this garbage? Is this what happened when your dog evolves? And I'm guessing that's a joke that maybe just doesn't make... Oh, no, because he's talking about your... Oh, okay, there's a small actual dog down there. Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense then. Never mind, I guess it's not a joke that's lost in translation. I just didn't notice a dog before, which is weird because that guy's name is Dog. But he has a dog. But the dog's not important at all. It's all just very confusing and unnecessary. Anyways, the ball of fuzz actually is a man who turns when Rogi addresses him, and he's like, you're a cleaner, but you're just some kid. He's like, what is this thing? And we don't actually get to see the conversation. We just cut to the next page where the, you know, furry man is playing a 3DS, and he just shows Rogi a shit ton of money, and he's like, I want you to go to the Bauble Company, and I want you to clean a matter up. It's the original of the augmentation unit. And Rogi's like, when you say clean up, he's like, yes, destroy the shit out of it. Now, excuse me, I've got more Tales of the Abyss to play. Oh, Luke, you're such a jerk. So we cut away to the Bauble Company, which, as mentioned, is a toy company. And Rogi gets in by essentially beating up some person outside and taking his, I guess, appointment notice? I guess appointment card? Maybe I don't go to enough fancy places that I actually, like, understand that they have appointment cards. But anyway, he's sitting there, and we see this big frog guy who we'll later know as Suzuki. Not that it really matters, but anyway, the frog's name is Suzuki, and it's actually a person in, like, a suit that I guess has augmentations in it. But anyway... one of the security guys asks him, like, oh, we're so glad you made it today. You're not the usual person, though, right? He's like, ah, yes, the usual person. He was attacked by a hoodlum, but he's not dead. I was just such a vested employee that I rushed to take his place on my day off. And he's like, ah, okay, well, that's very great. Nice to meet you. Let's show you around. And he's talking to him about how this is a toy company and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I've got some business to take care of, so, you know, don't you go wandering off and do anything bad. So Rogi, of course, does exactly that. He goes wandering about. He slips away from Suzuki and finds himself in what looks to be like a warehouse, like a storeroom, but it's full of basically just toys. And he's like, oh, okay, well, I guess this is just a wild goose chase. There's no weapons or anything here. And he swipes a key card, and a bunch of bookcases just open up, and there's, like, a fuck ton of guns behind it. He's like, oh, yeah, fucking dead end here. Ugh, fucking douchey old man. Nothing to blow up here at all. I'm out of here. And he leaves. And he doesn't. That's my interpretation of where I take the story in my comedy parody of Cyber Groggy. But instead he's like, oh, shit, those are toys, right? And then he turns around and a bunch of guards have guns pointed at him. And he's like, I mean, like, those are toys, right? And they're not. They start firing at him. So he goes running away. And then the frog, Suzuki, I don't know why I added a coon to it. Suzuki runs up and punches him and knocks Roggy for a ride. And they start talking about how they kind of knew he was one of the cleaners when he came in. So... they actually are kind of wanting to see what he can do in action. So the guards are there to kind of beat him up. And he's like, oh, you know, I can tell you're not a very nice company or anything like that. And he's like, yeah, I know we're not. And Roggy's like, well, if you're not a well-meaning company with overzealous security, then I don't need to hold back. And the frog's, you know, he starts crunching the frog's arm. And Suzuki's like, wait, I had this armor at max power! And Roggy's like, oh, really? Wait a second. Did you think you were going up against a human being? And then he hurls Suzuki into a wall and proceeds to just whoop everyone's ass. Mostly in comedic fashion. Like, he's riding around on, like, a cart, like a fucking, like, toy car, like a wind-up car at one point. You know, he's doing, like, the whole, like, I'm going to grab your arm and have you shoot your own allies and things like that. Almost slapstick at a point. And I didn't notice it now, but his high heels have blades, like, they're serrated edges on the end of them, or, like, on the back of them. Which is kind of fucking dark in its own way. If he fucking, like, hook kicks you, ugh. I mean, monstrous. But he finishes dispatching of all the soldiers, and he goes, takes an elevator, and he repeats in his mind, destroy it, huh? And there's a bear that he picked up that he's still holding onto that's ticking, and he's like, oh, is this a bomb? And it is. For some reason, he grabbed, like, a teddy bear bomb, so it blows him out of the elevator, and when he gets out of the elevator, he's in this dark room, and he sees a cage with a figure in it. You know, not to suppose what it is, but the figure looks to be, like, a woman in a dress of some kind, or a little girl in a dress. And, we get a flashback back to, I don't know if it's this, or the request he got earlier, or if it's supposed to be something even further back. Because the image we get is just a handprint on, like, maybe, like, glass or something like that. It's not exactly clear, but it's just a handprint, and it says, I have a request, since you seem to be so good at destroying things, Roggy. And then we cut back to the room, and an elevator door opens, and three figures are staying there, and one of them says, a pleasure to meet you, cleaner. And that's Cyber Groggy, and presumably that's also going to be Cyber Groggy as we get to know it, because this is the last Jumpstart chapter for it, and I'm not expecting this to be one of the series that continues on, which is a bit of a shame, because even though I have not been super excited about this series, I still think this is probably the best Jumpstart we've had in this run. I think I like Groggy the best, and it's not necessarily because of any one element. I think the world that it's built, I think, is a unique one. It hasn't felt very derivative, which has been a problem I've had with some of the other series, actually all the other Jumpstart series this round. Groggy feels more unique, like it stands alone. I think Groggy himself is an interesting character. He's fun, he's goofy when the story commands it, but, you know, he's able to buy into the dramatic parts pretty easily. Like, I even like the line where he's just like, you thought you were fighting something human? He's got just a kind of a quirky, unique style to it. Like, it's strange, but not, like, completely, like, it's strange in a good way, if you know what I mean. And in that sense, I think Groggy works well. I think the issue that I had with it early on was I think its narrative just wasn't spot on, and I think the art hasn't been great. I think, like, the first chapter was just a little bit too confusing. Like, I feel like it needed to be a little bit more streamlined for just getting Groggy into things and just establishing that he's, you know, this guy who cleans up the street. There was just a little too much going on with, like, Dog and everything like that. Like, I think Dog's kind of, like, a worthless character right now. I mean, he's barely in this chapter. So I think that maybe was working against it. But, I mean, I think overall, Rogi was the one I had the most optimism about of the three jump starts. That might not mean a whole lot. You know, it's only been three chapters for these series. But I really think that this guy worked. I think this worked well. And I don't know if necessarily this is someone like this. This isn't like, you know, Cross Manage and Kaito where I'm just like, you know, even if this guy doesn't do it, I'll follow his next one. I mean, I don't know if, you know, this guy's next piece is going to be as interesting for me because a lot of this is, you know, the world that I like. But I definitely hope this series has, you know, a good landing to it. I think overall it's been fun. And, yeah, it's, I guess that's, you know, that's what those are all about. The jump starts to give us a little taste of Japan, so. For that, I appreciate it. And then we'll move on into Fairy Tale, chapter 423, Do It All For Love. And I want to warn everybody right now, I did not read this chapter of Fairy Tale this week. Knowing that I was going into a solo episode, I figured, hey, people are always asking for it. Why don't I do another live reading? So I'm reading this chapter completely for the first time. I've not done it before. The only thing I've seen of this chapter thus far is the cover page. Which is all of Fairy Tail plus all the members of my Mia scale with the addition of a statue of Jura as they're all posing around being colorful and whatnot. And there's text to the side, but I'm not going to try to read it. So, we opened the chapter up where we left off last time with Natsu picking up Shira. What the fuck's her name? Sherry? Fuck, I can't remember her name. Sherry? I'm going to call him Sherry. I don't... You'll know what I'm talking. Oh, Sharia. That's right. It's weird. It's like almost a fucking person's name, but it's not. It's not Sherry or like Cheryl. It's Sharia. Like, what the fuck, Sharia? That's what pisses me off. Along with a lot of other things, but this specifically. Anyway. So, Natsu is picking up Sharia after the, you know, the whole attack from Blue Stinger, Blue Ringer, whatever the fuck his name was. And, Blue Note. That's right. Which... Rather amusingly, Natsu apparently didn't know who the fuck he was either. Because he's just like, that doesn't make sense. I don't know who you are. You're just a small... Oh no, sorry. Blue Note is the one saying, I remember him. He was just a small fry. But why does that other guy's annoying face keep popping up in my head? That's his voice. He just, I don't know. He just talks like a fucking... Like a guy about to burst. Like, Aah! So everyone starts falling down around Blue Note because he's using his gravity magic and he's super powerful. And he's like, I will crush you! So Natsu activates his fire powers and he's like, nobody's getting crushed! Da-goom! And I guess what he's doing is like propelling himself up with fire somehow. Because I guess that works. Anyway, he's using fire to propel himself upwards. It'd make more sense if he was like doing it like it's a, like a rocket blast. But the way it is like all the rocks are coming up with him too. So it's almost like he just created, like he just shot fire into the ground and it's like a torrent of fire is pushing it up. And that I don't get. Although I guess fire is not necessarily hindered by gravity. Is it? This is why science is not my best category on Trivia Crack. I swear if Nick was here, he'd be like, Chris, if you don't embarrass me with this, of course gravity is affected, or fire is affected by gravity. But I'm like, I don't know, Nick. You're not here. So this is Christopher Science today. Yeah, I should probably move on instead of getting caught up on that for like 20 minutes. Natsu says, Fairy Tale will never be crushed. And that's when Blue Note's like, Fairy Tale? I remember it now! And, why did we cut back to Natsu? Because he's like, it was Fairy Tale, and he sees Natsu's face, and he sees Gildard's face. But it cuts back to Natsu so we can, like, continue his lame-o fucking, lather, rinse, repeat speech. Don't you try to crush us! And Blue Note gets, I guess, destroyed by Natsu's fire breath. Holy shit, that's huge. That is redonkulous. Yeah, they killed the shit out of Blue Note. I mean, I'm probably going to kill him. Maybe. What? I just looked at the next page. I hate this series sometimes. God damn it, Fairy Tail. All right. So Natsu used his super awesome, mega powerful fire breath blast. It created, it even got its own two-page spread where you can see how monumentally huge it is. Like, you can see the little black figures down there that are trees, and you can see the little black figure that's Natsu. So you can see that this blast was e-fucking-normous. It was huge. He fires it out. It takes out Blue Note. Blue Note's still staying afterwards, but he's very singed. And you can see his clothes have taken a little bit of damage from, like, his little bits of tears here and there on his clothes. So, we then go to the next page, where everyone is reacting to this. And Carla is like, one shot! And Wendy's like, how much stronger has Natsu-san gotten in the past? Oh, fuck, I need a wacky voice for Wendy. She's Whoopi Goldberg. How much stronger has Natsu gotten in this past year? I don't know why. It's a terrible Whoopi Goldberg. Alright, but no. The fucking ridiculously bad thing is Natsu is now holding Sharia. And he's like, he's trying to scold her about kidnapping. Because she took Happy. And she says, I think you burned my top off. Which is rather obviously pointed out, because even though he's still holding on to, like, a part of her clothing, she very obviously is having to cover up her breasts because her shirt has been singed off. Which then leads me to the point of, why is it, like, how is this fire so selective in what clothing it decides to burn off? I can just, you know, fathom, like, alright, Natsu must have some heat-proof clothes. That just must be something he buys. Why is every, like, any other time he does this, it seems to be only the women who have their clothes burned off? And why is it only their clothes? Why, like, clearly that fire blast was not intended to just burn Blue Note's clothes off. He fucking annihilated him with this, like, fucking beam of fire. You know, he's singed, his face is burning. So why is it that the only effect that had on Sharia was to burn her top off? Why does this exist? It is... Oh, God, I hate this series sometimes. I don't know, I shouldn't be spending, like, 5 minutes pointing this out, but it's so weird. How does this happen? This is, like, the most fucking obtuse method of getting fucking fan service in here. Ugh, alright. Yeah, and once again, it is, of course, the 16-year-old who has her top fucking burned off, but, you know, what are you gonna do? Anyway, the other members of fucking Kozen's Queef, I don't remember the name of their guild, and I don't think it's going to, because they just surrender anyway. So, we're back at, like, the safety moment afterwards, where, you know, everybody's celebrating. Lumia Scale's like, yep, all the monsters left, you were a huge help. Natsu's complaining because he's like, that wasn't enough action, I wanted more. And then Lucy's like, where are Wendy and Sharia? And Loki says, I guess Loki was his name a long time ago. Leo says, if they were a few years older, I'd... Which is weird. Like, I know it's... I guess no one's there to shit on him for it, but I feel like the intention of that joke is to be like, those girls are too young for you. Which I would like to then point you to a page before where you were showing this girl with her naked, shirtless body. Which is really kind of defeating the point if you're going to insult Loki or Leo for being a bit of a pervert and you know, ogling these fucking underage girls. And then you do it too, hero. It's just like, that's a little inappropriate. Anyway, Sherry is like, well, so much for my plan. And he's like, what plan are you talking about there, girl? It's not Whoopi Goldberg at all. It's just my Jersey voice that I'm trying to, like, pretend is Whoopi Goldberg. Holy shit. Oh, God. Anyway, Sherry says, I just want to show you that I could do just fine on my own. But then Natsu had to blow the whole thing to pieces. And that's when Wendy's like, yeah, Natsu's a real fuck like that. He's always stealing everyone's spotlight. But then Sherry's like, Wendy, you really should go with Natsu. I mean, you love him, don't you? What? Okay, hold on. Let me actually read this. Hold on. You love him, don't you? Wendy's like, what? No, I just, I don't, it's not anything like that. I just kind of look up to him like a big brother. And Sherry is like, that's love too, you know. And if you don't go, you'll regret it. Remember what Natsu said, fairy tale could never be crushed. And because I love you, Wendy, I know that your love for fairy tale is what made you who you are today. Why is the word love, like, it's written in like a special font? Like, I get you're trying to be like, yeah, love's a powerful word. I don't know why, it just feels like you're pointing out too much. It's a nitpick, I don't need to spend 20 minutes on that. She's telling her, be true to your heart, Wendy. We'll still be friends, even if we aren't in the same guild anymore. And then they sit down. And they're holding hands against Sunrise. And, I mean, I guess, you know, I've never been like a 16-year-old girl or a 14-year-old girl or whatever Wendy is. So maybe I've never had that point in my life where I was like, you know what I want to do? I want to enjoy my fucking sunset closed hand in hand with my best friend who's half naked. And I mean, it's, maybe that's a gender thing or a fucking Japan thing. I had someone link this to me and they were just like, yeah, sure, love. I get the sense of it's a very platonic friendship based love. Though I would not be shocked if Hiro was drawing it for the sense of hitting on a Yuri fetish of some kind. Maybe not fetish. I don't think it's necessarily meant to be sexual, but just hating on that, like, alternate crowd. I don't know. And Carl is watching. She's back in her cat form, I guess, because they didn't feel any need to, like, have people jerk off right after that. There's a picture of a tree. And then everyone's like, thank you for everything you did, Wendy. Wow. I know, Wendy's saying thank you, everybody, for what you did for me. And Wendy says, I don't really know what to say. I need to apologize to everybody for being so selfish. I guess Carla made the agreement ahead of time that they'd only be staying until Fairy Tail came back. That's enough of that. Chin up. Wendy and Carla never forgot about our fairy. Oh, man, this really works. This is all lame. The weird dog guy's like, I'll take your place in the Sky Sisters. And the grandma's like, I'll do it instead. And she's like, her saggy tits are in some kind of like bustier. It's, God. Oh God, how much longer is this? Alright, so we're not getting Fairy Tail back together. Say hi to Gray. Oh yeah, we lost track of him someplace. Blah blah blah. Remember you forever. I'll remember you guys too. We had such great memories, like the stuff we established last, like 2 weeks ago, where I guess we were friends, but I didn't do anything with you guys except for, like, presumably practice being an underage jailbait model. Leon tells Sherry she can cry if she wants. She's like, I'm not gonna cry because I want Fairy Tail back too. And Wendy's crying. Oh, God. This sucks. All right, hold on. Natsu's like, this is just the beginning. We're going to get everybody together again. And apparently they're like, all right, where to next? And Lucy's like, if we go east from here, there's a place they're calling the Village of the Rainbringer. And they say the rain never lets up there, so it probably is Juvia. Dun, dun, dun. And that's the chapter, and thank God. And she's apparently the Rain Woman again. She's super depressed and pissed off. All right. Alright, so, this chapter sucked. Holy shit. I mean, it was just an annoying read, but I don't get, like, you made this whole little mini arc about bringing Wendy back into the group, and I don't know anything about Wendy from this except that she's friends with Sherry, which I don't think we needed to reestablish. Like, I get that. Like, what has Wendy been doing in the past 2 years? Like, if you're going to be like, alright, Fairy Tail was split up, and the reason they didn't all get together is because they all wanted to go their own ways. Like, that was the crux of it, at least at the start. Like, Gray went out to go, you know, bury his father and to kind of put rest to those demons, and Juvia went with him. And presumably, you know, Luxus and his team went out and they were going to train because they wanted to be strong enough, and that's what Natsu was doing. And presumably, a lot of these different splinter groups, you know, all headed out, and presumably, you know, my thought was that they'd all have their own ambitions. They were all going out to do something, and that's what we are going to see now. You know, we're going to see what they've been doing in the past 2 years, and we see what Wendy's been doing in the past 2 years, and it's fucking nothing, apparently. She just found another guild to act as her surrogate family for 2 years until Fairy Tail would eventually get their shit together. And she's like, all right, and now I'm going to leave. But I have a bestie now, and I'm always going to be friends with her. And that's what we got out of this, which is fine if you're like, you know, she really built this strong emotional connection with these people. I don't really buy this as anything spectacular, but I'm just like, but why did Wendy... Like, why did she go out on her own? Like, I don't get it. She could have hung out with the rest. Like, this all boils back to the fucking notion of why everyone in Fairy Tail decided, like, let's just stop. Let's just go home. Let's give up. Everybody go home. Because one person decided they didn't want to be in Fairy Tail for, like, the next 2 years, so none of us will be. It's just really weird and clumsy, and it's just a shame that you were going to do this arc where you're going to build up to reintroducing Wendy to the reader, and reintroducing is a time skip when nothing fucking happened, but you're going to reintroduce her into the group. You're going to make a big deal about picking up Wendy and going after these individual members, and you do it, and Wendy does fucking nothing this entire arc except be like, I'm sure I'm friends with you, Sharia. We are friends. Like, again, we don't really see any instance of them being friends. There was no, like, really small moment where the two had anything, except, like, they did, like, their wind dragon combination power. It just feels like... Ugh. God, it's just a shitty chapter. It didn't mean anything. God, I hope they aren't all like this. I really hope the other ones are more, like, character-focused, or at least short. Because this was, like, 3 weeks that essentially amounted to nothing. You could have just had Wendy show up at Lucy's house and be like, hey guys, I heard you're back. I'm going to join up with you. Nothing about Wendy's character has changed in this. There is no development in her for what supposedly happened 2 years ago. She has no other ambitions. She has no other, like... It's not like she went anywhere to discover something else about herself. She just went to another fucking guild that was just as similar to her previous one as she could possibly find and hung out with them until this year came around. We don't even know if she was going on guild missions or anything like that. Like, they didn't even go into that detail. The only thing we saw of Wendy in regards to this guild was that she fucking formed a, like, underage jailbait singing service with them. Yeah, it's just, it's annoying to me. Like, it's just a fucking waste. Alright. Hold on a moment. Let me prepare myself. Alright, sorry about that. I apologize. It's very unprofessional to be drinking audibly on a podcast and to stop for it, but when you're one man, you only go for so long. Fucking that chapter bothered the shit out of me. I don't know why. Holy shit, I should do live readings. That was awful. Alright, so, Food Wars. Shokugeki no Soma, chapter 109, Those Who Shine. We pick up where we were last week with the member of the academy coming in saying, hey, you guys pass. And they mentioned specifically to Soma and Arato at first, but the more important thing comes in. We see a conversation between Todokoro and Eruna. Todokoro is trying to leave, and Eruna's like, why don't you just take my limos here and I'll give you a ride. So they do, and, you know, Todokoro is obviously super nervous because she's like, what the fuck? This chick's got such a nice van or limo, and there's, like, a fridge and a mini bar, and it's so sparkly and I'm awkward. But she does manage to talk, and she thanks Eruna for her help because she says, if you hadn't been there, I never would have gotten Chef Kasayama to listen to my opinion, and, you know, because of you, I'm basically able to pass. And Eruna's like, you know, you really need to have more confidence in yourself, you know? Like, it wasn't, you know, nothing to be able to make it to the top 8 of the Fall Classic. You know, you should have some pride in yourself. I don't really know how someone of your talent reigned unknown for so long. And, you know, Todokoro kind of nervously dances around the fact that she was dead last on the acceptance test. But she notes, you know, she's doing better now because of the people who have met her, you know, who she's met, the people at her dorm who have been able to get her this far. And she notes specifically Soma, who helped get me there, and we've been paired together and this and that. And, you know, she turns over and Aaron has, like, puffed up her cheeks. And she's like, you can stop talking about him. Thank you very much. And then Todokoro's like, oh, okay, I guess I'll pick up on this hint. And then she's like, all right, I'll alleviate the situation, being like, hey, you spent a lot of time at Miss Arado, right? And that also depresses Erina, as Erina seems to be thinking back to the times where, I guess, the two of them, her and Arato, spent time together. I guess they were childhood friends or something like that. The more important thing is that it then cuts away back to Somar and Naruto, who are now kind of talking. They're kind of saying their goodbyes. And, you know, Naruto's kind of down on herself. She's like, you know, it's pathetic, isn't it? I still can't find my confidence. Even though I managed to do this, I've just been complacent. I was like, all I had to do was follow Arena's footsteps. That's all I needed to do. And flashes back to what I assume is when Hayama beat her in the tournament. And he, I guess, gave her a rather cutting remark about a chef so desperate to be only number two could never be a match for me. And Soma, like, brushes it off, and he's like, you just need to quit trying to follow in her footsteps. Instead, make yourself into someone who can stand beside her. Because, you know, I lost to Hayama too, but how about you say we both return the favor? You with me? And she, you know, Aruto's just not completely bought into it yet. She's like, no, I've lost. I'm not worthy of. So Soma gives her a quote. He says, if there's an ideal you really want to reach, forget appearances and cling to it as hard as you can. You said it yourself not too long ago. That's a quote from last week. And then he hands her a bunch of manga that I guess he wanted to give Erina. I'm hoping it's like filthy, like doujinshi porno manga. And like she just doesn't see it. Like she's just like so kind of like... She's like... Arato's just so like warmed by the gesture and the kind words that she doesn't even like look at it. Just like hardcore like fuck porn. She's just like, oh my! I don't know why she's Winnie the Pooh in my mind. Like, oh bother! But, as she leaves, Soma stops and looks at the sky, and he's like, and I think I'm going to take my own advice, too. I will. This whole time, all I've been doing is following behind my dad, walking in his footsteps. But now that's going to change. I'm going to get a big eye full of the world outside of Yukihara, and then I'm going to find my own cooking and start shining a new light for others to follow. So this is kind of him getting his... final sort of closure to that character development he started a couple weeks back, where he noted that he wanted to change his character. You know, he wanted to start finding his own cooking, and not seek to just be like his dad. He had to find his own unique, distinct style. So that's kind of what we're getting here. That's a closure of that, and we cut away to this fancy restaurant as a news report talks about how this new owner is one of the top culinary chefs, and he's mentioning all the talk about culinary schools and then, you know, top rising prospects, and, you know, he's opening his new restaurant. It's going to be super awesome. We see the guy, and he's talking on a phone, and he mentions that Chef... What's his name? Chef Dojima. Dojima is telling... having one of the members of the school come to him for stagiaire week. And this guy is like, I don't want some brat here. If I can't, you know, I have any time to babysit incompetent dunces. Actually, he's French, so let's make him Benza. Anyway, I do not have time to babysit any more incompetent dunces. But wait! So you tell Chef Dojima this. If he sends someone useless, I'll put them right back. And he opens the door, and of course it's Soma. And Soma says, sup, Chef Shinomiya, looking forward to working with you. And Chef Shinomiya, whose name I know because it's literally right there in front of me, is like, grrr. And from what I understand, this is someone that Soma previously faced off against. I have not yet gotten to that point in my catch-up of the series to know that, but that is apparently what he did. So, this is a callback to that guy. And Soma's going to be working with him one-on-one. So it looks like we might get another little small arc here as he works his way through it. But I like this chapter. I like this chapter a lot. I like getting more focus on these characters and their developments. I like Soma's motivation of being like, it's time for me to stop following in someone else's footsteps. It's gotten me places. but I need to start actually trying to define myself rather than define myself by what my father, you know, by what my ambitions were to stand by my father. I need to be, or rather follow after my father. I want to be someone that can stand beside him, not one that follows after him. I need to create my own identity. I like that. And I like that he also gives that same encouragement to Arato, because it is very, very related to her situation. She's someone who's constantly just trying to think how she can be useful to Arena and follow after, as opposed to thinking of herself as her own individual, and seeing how that can then be an assistance to the people she cares about, which in that case would be Arena. So I really like this chapter. I like what Soma did. I thought that was nice. I like the little talk Tadakoto and Arena had in the car. I thought both of those were nice. I like that Arena is actually respecting her. And I like it. It's just a really good chapter. I think Shokugeki no Soma, Food Wars, has been one of the better series in the magazine this past few weeks. So I've been greatly enjoying it. I think I actually may have given it my top ranking this week in the Jump rankings. I'm not entirely sure. If it wasn't this one, it might have been Gakkyo Hotei. I may have given it to Gakkyo Hotei. I think I actually did. I'm trying to remember. I feel like I did. Why would... I guess it really doesn't matter. But anyway, I like this chapter, and I thought it was very good. Which then brings us to Gakkyo Hotei, Chapter 13, Civil Trial Arc 3, The Staircase of Truth. And last week, Baku told Sarutobi that, you know, you may have attracted all this awesome evidence, but what you've done is only set up the perfect turn for my roundabout. And he starts off this week with an image of him climbing a set of steps. And he says, Say you have a flight of 10 steps, and using just evidence, you've gotten to the 7th step. But sometimes the truth apparent at step 7 is vastly different from what's visible at step 10. Sometimes they're like polar opposites. Then, what can we attorneys lean on to climb the remaining 3 steps? And Sarutobi's like, can you stop talking about numbers? I suck at math. And Baku's like, this really isn't math. Holy shit. But he says, alright, let me explain it to it. First, the two shared a common hidden ground in Miss Van Gogh. She's Picasso's teacher and Da Vinci's sister. Those are the respective ties beneath them. And both boys exploited Miss Van Gogh's weakness to pressure her into painting for him. The proof is these rough sketches you found in her house in the first of the two works. I agree with you up until this point. I do think Miss Van Gogh was forced to be in the ghostwriter for both. But the plagiarism mess, there's something that still can't be explained by that. And that is the genesis of these two identical paintings. And, he notes that there are only rough sketches of the first two pairs and not the third. Why is that? Yeah, it's just like, I don't know, maybe she just threw them away, yet kept the older ones around? That doesn't make sense. He says, think about it. If you were Miss Van Gogh, would you paint the exact same thing for each of them? Do that when the rumors of plagiarism already exist and you'll cause a lawsuit for sure. Why would a teacher who can't let it be known that she's ghostwriting for her students do such a thing? In short, the conclusion I draw here is that Miss Van Gogh wasn't the one who painted this third pair of works. Gasp! And everyone's like, what? But then it gets even better because he's like, well, if Miss Van Gogh didn't paint it, then who did? The only commonality you found between those two, even with all your intel gathering skills, was Miss Van Gogh, right? Then we just take it at face value. The only ones who could have painted those pieces are Picasso and Da Vinci themselves! Another bombshell! And Sarutobi is obviously like, what? That's crazy! Why would the two paint the same painting by this, you know, by accident? It's impossible! And he's like, no, it was intentional! And Sarutobi's like, that doesn't even make more sense! Well, that's probably what he should say, because he has bad English and grammar, like I just did there. But he's like, no, that makes even less sense! Why would they paint the same piece when they're already under rumors of plagiarism? And Baku says, yes, it's just for that reason I explained earlier that I knew that they would do such a thing. Do that when rumors of plagiarism already exist and you'll cause a lawsuit for sure. That's right. Both their motives were, in fact, to get a classroom session convened. And we're on the 8th step now. And everyone's like, what? What are you talking about? Why would you want to have a classroom session? He's like, well, all sorts of truths get revealed during a classroom session, no? And there's one more truth here that still hasn't come to light. Saratobi, it looks like you didn't peek deeper than the surface, but I think the key is the weakness the two used to intimidate her. I mean, think about it. A ghost teacher, a teacher ghost writing for her students isn't normal. What the heck would that weakness be that would make a teacher agree to it? While pondering this, I recall to phrase to fight fire with fire. In short, use a ghost writer to ghost write. Miss Van Gogh, I hear you're studying under noted painter something Yamo at art college, but aren't you? Oh, I knocked over shit in my house. Fuck. She's like, aren't you also ghost painting for him? For Sarayone Yamo? Am I wrong? And everyone's like, what the fuck? And Tonto's like, Miss Van Gogh painting her works as Baku just established previous panel? Oh, my head's so confuzzled. And Baku explains, I have two grounds for my theory. First were your words the other day that you can't seem to paint anything original. I initially thought it was because painting for Picasso and Da Vinci didn't leave her much time. But grade school art shouldn't be that hard to, you know, push out, so I knew something else had to be up here. And says, the second is that I noticed that the day how Surinari Yamo and Miss Van Gogh's paintings were similar in the same way Miss Van Gogh's paintings and Picasso's were. Back then, I thought it was just a reflection of the mentor's influence, but it's equally valid to conclude that as the latter case was attributable to ghostwriting, then so too can the former be. Since not even an art expert like me could tell through looking at the art, but it has to have been more obvious to the two boys, who have been looking at Miss Van Gogh's art for a very long time. And so they blackmailed her, and we see images of the two boys basically commanding Miss Van Gogh to paint them different artworks, and they have these very insidious faces on them, saying, I want you to paint my pieces for me too! Both of them basically blackmailing her into painting their artwork so that they would keep the secret of her being a ghostwriter for Yamo a secret. And Saratobe's like, I'm even more confused now! Ain't it odd? Those two are terrible, yet... I don't know why I was going into you, Abakumo. Yeah, fuck it, go for it. Those two are terrible, but still, why force a lawsuit when such secrets of theirs might get revealed? Abakumo's like, yeah, they sure are losers and they ran. The risk of being branded plagiarist, psych! You thought I was going to call them losers and they ran, but no, I was actually using it as a wordplay. Gotcha. Anyway, on to my actual point. That's how badly they wanted the truth to come out during this school judgment in order to save Miss Van Gogh from Yamo's clutches. And everyone's like, save her? And, you know, we see Sasuke in the crowd. I know his name's not Sasuke, but he's Sasuke to me. He's like, ah, so that's it. Like, he's now grasped everything. And Baku comes to Picasso and he's like, well, there you have it, Picasso. We finally reached the ninth step. I'm your attorney. It's my job to represent your interests, and I have the confidence in my abilities to do so. But you're welcome to climb the final step yourself, if you'd like. And he hands out his hand, and Picasso and Da Vinci basically take that last step together. And it seems that, I guess, Picasso is the one saying this mentally. He's like, thanks, I'm glad I put my trust in you. And they start going on about how I just want Miss Van Gogh to be like how she was before. Ever since she started art college, she just didn't seem to enjoy painting anymore. And after some research, we figured it out. You know, we found out that she was being the ghostwriter for her teacher's work as well. I decided to consult Da Vinci and found out that he was her little brother. And when we put our heads together, we thought of ways to help her. We did consider other avenues of bringing this to life, but we didn't think anyone would take us grade schoolers seriously. And if we did a half-baked job, then Yamo would get off and Van Gogh would be screwed. You know, she'd just have the accusation, she'd lose her job, everything like that. So that's why we created the exact same painting, to bring about this classroom arbitration. The judgment would have final, actual binding legal force, and most of all, pros would be collecting the evidence and proving the truth for us, so we'd be able to pin down Yamo for sure. And Baku continues, you actually had Miss Van Gogh paint for you from the start to start the rumors of plagiarism, and used it all as basically a long con to get this courtroom case so that you could bring out this truth about Yamo's actual, you know, the ghostwriting situation. And, you know, Saratobi's like, you went through all this just for that? Are you stupid? And Ibaku explains, it might be idiotic. But as for why, let me tell you something. I've met plenty of folks, such folks in this class, right? Those who envy, or have a crush, or are pursuing an ideal, or just want to protect someone precious to them. It's always a person's heart that causes an incident, which is why we attorneys must uncover that heart, as well as the evidence. Or else, we can't get up those last three steps, see? Oh, holy shit, that was a long time of fucking talking. Holy fuck. Ugh, all right, we're good. Immediately the two kids start apologizing, you know, they're so sorry that they brought this upon her, and Miss Van Gogh's like, no, I really, you know, I'm the one who should apologize. I really thought you two were doing this just out of your rivalry, and I assumed one of you had copied the other. She explains the reason that she's been ghostwriting for Mr. Yamo has been because she couldn't pay her tuition, and this is, you know, he brought the offer to her. Apparently this is something that she's been known for before, so she had to start doing it. But as the bigger his name got because of her paintings, the bigger her guilt became, and it eventually reached a point where she could no longer enjoy painting. It just became something she had to do to keep surviving, and it was bringing her down on herself. And you know, she knew it's even a shot of her like painting against like a glass window of some kind about how she could never be her old self again, and I'm just a ghost. And she starts crying. She says, "I gave up on myself, even though you two never did. I was a bad big sister and a terrible teacher, too." And everyone hugs together and they're like, "I'm so sorry." And everyone gathers together and they can be like, "Yeah, it's all right. We, you know, we managed to find out the truth. And this time, getting to paint her own stuff, too. Just like she used to. Yeah. Woo. We did it." And they did. The judge gives his announcement. He's like, "I hereby proclaim judgment. First, I counsel both plaintiffs and the accused to settle. Furthermore, to encourage remorse for deceiving even your attorneys and usurping a classroom session for your own purposes, I sentence you to weed the courtyard. Oh, along with you two idiot attorneys." But they do note as well that it seems that Mr. Yamo is going to have this reflected on him, and he's going to have to show up in a real court just as well. And the two painters are talking about, like, "Wow, I can't believe it worked out just like you said. I guess our class really has an incredible attorney." And we cut over to Baku and Sarutobi, and Sarutobi is explaining, he's like, "I lost, you know. It's just like you said, I relied only on evidence and didn't try to dig deeper into what this case was actually about. And I got obsessed with competing against you," and I, you know, it cuts to him when he turned to, was it Da Vinci, I think was his, and he's like, "I don't care about you, this is just about me being a Baku." And then it juxtaposes that by turning to Baku when he was like, "I'm your attorney and it's my job to represent your interests," and then it just goes to show the differences of their character, that Baku, even in that battle between these two friends, ultimately cared about his client, and that was the important factor. As Sarutobi admits, he's like, "The thing I forgot most about being an attorney was caring about your client." Baku actually notes, he's like, "Well, you know, it's not as though the evidence wasn't important, though. It's fact, I knew what was happening, but I didn't have any proof. So it was only because of you and your ability to gather all this evidence that was possible. So really, I think this counts as a draw." And then he says, "Sarutobi, why don't you ask your open your own office? You know, there's no reason our class can't have two attorneys, neither one above or below the other. You stay right at my side." And they cut back to a little bit of a flashback between them to when they were all in prison. And Baku was this big whiny crybaby, and Sarutobi's like, "Is crying going to solve anything? Not a bit. We didn't commit any crime. This is ridiculous. We can't depend on the adults, which means we kids will do everything ourselves. The three of us are going to prove our innocence and get out of here someday." And Baku, you know, it's weird, because that's a flashback that it goes back into the flashback from before when Baku and Tento were talking about the bloody classroom session, where Baku was playing. That was, you know, from when that point on, he started studying law and debate to become attorneys and prove their innocence. And we get Tonto, he's like, "They told me all of this quite casually, but I bet Unugami carries around a past that I can't even begin to imagine. Oh, I don't know who Unugami is, though. I only know first names. Oh. Tento's daddy say that I shouldn't try to learn two names. That caused all sorts of problems in Tento head. Oh. Tento gonna have to eat the cat tonight now. Oh. Oh, yeah. And yet he managed to overcome all of it. Sometimes respect is hard to admit, but you try hard because you don't want to lose. No matter how many stairs you climb, and these figurative stairs, not literal stairs. Tento not allowed to use real stairs. He had to be thrown upstairs by Dad. Dad say, 'Tento, you clean basement,' and he tossed Tento downstairs, head first. And Tento land because his head super thick." I don't know why I'm making him such an asshole. And it's actually a pretty cool quote. He's like, "No matter how many stairs you have to climb, there's always a set of soldiers next to you. And you're going to be able to keep climbing thanks to having such a rival." And it kind of goes into a little bit of a more, a little bit of a longer explanation about how the Van Gogh, after this, basically stopped painting, and she quit art college, and she basically did one of those journeys of self-discovery. You know, she went out into the world to find herself. And eventually a painting showed up at Tenpin Elementary, and it depicted three similar silhouettes standing at the top of a really long staircase. And it looked to all of us like her face was smiling. And it says, the title of it is Bonds by Miss Van Gogh. And that's the chapter this week of Gakkyo Hotei, which, holy shit, doing the entire thing on my own. My voice feels like it hurts already. But that was a really good chapter. I really actually enjoyed this series a good deal, and this chapter particularly. I think this was a really cool kind of close to this. I really liked what this established of Ubaku here. I really love the moment where he's just like, you know, he puts away everything to do with this robber or Sarutobi and trying to prove himself better than him. So he basically says, I'm your attorney, and you're the important piece of this. I could take you up this last step and give you the truth, but I want you to be the one to, you know, you can make that decision yourself. It basically gives Picasso the chance to actually explain his logic and reasoning behind all of this. And I really like the, there were some great quotes in here about that, you know, of, I'm your attorney, and this whole metaphor of the stairs, you know, is a little cheesy at first, but it worked. I liked a lot of this chapter, you know. It's always a person's heart that causes the incident, which is why we attorneys must uncover that heart as well as the evidence. It's just really cool stuff there, and I really dug it. I like what we got out of Sarutobi. I like this as an introduction to Sarutobi. I guess because the decision was to settle, it wasn't in favor of any one or the other artist, so in that sense, I guess this means Sarutobi's record is still perfect as well. So I really dug that. I thought this was an exceptional chapter of this series. I really enjoyed it, and I hope we get another good little arc after this. I don't know what maybe they'll do from here. I think it might be a little bit too early to bring in the previous, or the third tongue, like, you know, showing, having that person show up as another rival. Because again, I'm assuming she's a prosecutor. But I'm assuming we're gonna jump into another case, and at that point, I guess they go back to Pine, or maybe this is when they'll introduce someone else. But I don't know. There's a lot of development still going on for the series, so it's kind of a case of let's just see where they decide to go with this at this point. But regardless, I thought this was a really good chapter, and if I didn't, I should have made this my favorite of the week, because this was a really enjoyable one. So, let's move along to My Hero Academia, Chapter 33, Shinso's Methods, which some of you may not have realized was the chapter title, because the chapter cover is actually done like an old, I guess current comic books do it similar, but it's, you know, set up like an old American comic book with like the logo in the top, and that's actually where the title was. But we introduced this week with... I wrote it down, but I still know how to pronounce Midoriya. I'm going to call him Deku, and just understand that's who I mean. I know his name is not Deku, but I'm calling him Deku because I don't know how to pronounce these names. And everyone's like, what? He's frozen in place. You know, what is happening here? Is this all because of Shinso's quirk? You know, this is a guy none of us even really care about existing, but, you know, he definitely is one we got to keep an eye on. And the commentators note that Shinso failed the practical part of the exam, so he lost a spot in the hero course, but he was able to get in general studies, and that's, you know, kind of what he's been hoping for. You know, he had to do it because his quirk wouldn't help him out in the actual physical aspects of the competition. They just weren't, you know, beneficial in that way. And Shinso kind of continues by saying, it must be nice to have everything handed to you, Deku. Now turn around and walk out of the ring. And that's what Deku starts doing. He turns around and starts walking out of the ring. And they noted, Satoshi Shinso, quirk, brainwashing. Anyone who verbally responds to him is instantly brainwashed and will do whatever he commands. However, the brainwashing won't work if he doesn't will it. So it's all defined by like kind of a hypnotic battle of will. As long as Shinso agree, or, you know, is focused in on it happening. Oh, excuse me. As long as he's focused in on it happening, it will happen. So Deku is walking. He can't do anything about it. You know, All Might's just like, no, stop walking. What are you doing? And, you know, Deku in his mind's like, don't do it, don't, you know, my body won't listen to me, my head, oh, it's so fuzzy, and, oh, even after Ojiro warned me about this, and we cut away to a flashback where Ojiro, who many of you might remember as the tail guy we saw last week, who gave up the match because he didn't want to, you know, admit what happened, he explains how my loss might be your gain, because what I've learned is my memories were cut out from the instant I helped him, and I think that's the trick. You know, it seems like whatever you do, don't reply to him, because that way we won't have to, you know, you won't get brainwashed by it. And he says the only time I snapped out of it was when we bumped into Tetsu Tetsu's formation. So it seems that physical contact will break the brainwashing when you get into it. But if you get into it, it's a one-on-one match, so no one's going to be able to help you. So, you know, you're screwed otherwise. You know, you can't get into this. But obviously, we know that's what's happening. Deku screamed out to him last chapter. He's under the brainwashing. He's walking towards it, and he sees the doorway in front of him. And a bright light shines within it, and then all of a sudden he starts seeing all these shadowy figures. You know, you're just making out slight impressions of faces, like heads, and the two, like, sinister-looking eyes. And it scares out of it for a moment. For a moment, it starts to appear in his own head. And he's like, is this? And suddenly he has the ability to move his fingers. And he does so. He actually moves his two fingers and basically breaks his own fingers to force himself out of the mind control. And everyone's like, what? Deku, he stopped. How did he do it? And they know, you know, he used his own fingers with the power of All Might to basically break his fingers to use the physical contact, but everyone's like, how did he actually gain enough control over himself to do that? It's not like Shinso commanded him to do that. And Deku goes on to explain, he's like, you know, he refers to the All for One, how it's passed down like an Olympic torch, and he wonders if those people that he was seeing, is this a sign that he's linked by this power to all those different people in the past? Kind of like he's haunted by the ghosts of everyone else who has used the All for One power, the One for All power. Or that rather, maybe they have saved him. Maybe he's not being haunted by them so much as they're watching over him, kind of like an avatar effect or something like that. But he notes that, and he says, just thinking about it won't give me any answers. There's no time for that now, so I'll need to think about it later. I just gotta wait for him to open. I just gotta beat this guy and not answer him. So Shinso basically tries to go back into doing it, trying to taunt him into using his power again. You know, like, hey, thanks to my quirk's nature, I couldn't. Essentially, what Shinso does is he starts ranting again. He's talking about how, you know, he has this gift, this quirk, but it's not a special one, like something like an All Might or, you know, like Bakugan or whatever, the guy with the explosion. Basically, this is a quirk that can't help him in a physical situation, so he's not blessed, and he's taunting him for that point, too. And he's like, you know, it's thanks to my quirk's nature, I couldn't enter the Golden Gates. You wouldn't get that because you're naturally blessed. You people, born with your awesome quirks, gain to follow all your dreams! And Deku's like, no, you do. I do get it. I am blessed. I'm blessed with the people in my life, and that's why I'm... And Shinsu's trying to punch him, basically get him to do anything to answer back to him, but instead Deku just flips him over and he says, I'm not gonna lose! And he slams Shinsu to the ground, and Shinsu's legs tap on the outside of the arena, and he is declared out, which means Deku moves on to the second round. The crowd's actually cheering, but I don't have a crowd sound effect, so I did it with my mouth. I know you may have thought for a moment you had been whisked away to, you know, MetLife Stadium, and the Giants just scored another touchdown. Victor Cruz was salsing, and, you know, the crowd's like, again, you're not actually there, I know. It may seem like I'm brainwashing you and you feel like you're in MetLife Stadium, but in actuality, that's just me holding my hands up against my mouth and making a sound. Hold on. You thought you were there again, but you're not. You're actually right here, still in the comfort of your own home, unless you are at MetLife Stadium. In which case, how are you listening to this podcast? I feel like they wouldn't get enough streaming bandwidth there if you're on the center of the field. Anyway, this was a good chapter this week. I like this. I like what we got out of Shinso. I thought, you know, this is a quick fight, which you kind of need when you're going to do a long battle tournament in a series. But I like what we got at Ishinso. I guess, this is the first time I've really seen him. There's still a couple chapters of the series I need to catch up on, and maybe he's plays any kind of role in those as well. But in this, I like it because they clearly gave this guy a personality that was more than just, I control your powers. You know, they give this guy also kind of a sympathetic story about how he can't enter into the school in normal fashion because, you know, he's not gifted like everybody else. His power is mental. His power relates just to controlling other people. He himself is just a normal person. And, you know, he's bitter and angry about it, and Deku beats him because of it. And it seems like this is a character you can develop going forward. Like, this is a guy you can show up back again later on in the series, and you can continue to develop his personality. You can add more to him. You can give him a heroic, triumphant return to this. So, Deku beating him, obviously cool. I think he himself was a very cool character. And I dug it greatly. I thought this was a really good chapter. So, that moves us on then into One Piece, chapter 779, His Final Battle. And our chapter starts off with Zoro and the after effects of the battle, and he goes on to have a flashback to his time with Mihawk, when Mihawk explains to him how he's like, oh, hey, have you ever broken a blade? And Zoro's like, yeah, a few times. In fact, you did it to me, asshole. He's like, oh, whoops. But if you had infused them with haki, those swords would not have been broken. You should treat every one of those broken swords as a mark of shame, because every weapon can be turned into a black blade like mine. No liquor until you've mastered that feat. And Zoro laughs to himself, knowing that full well he has mastered it and used it effectively in combat to defeat Pika. We then cut away to basically all the different areas of the battle. You know, Fujitora is asking if there are any injured, which they're like, no, thanks to your help, all the pieces just floated away. Basically confirming that Fujitora has a gravity-based devil fruit. I know some people are like, maybe it's a meteor one, but clearly it's gravity-based if he's making things float away, too. And then we see, you know, the different people up on the roof where things were about to get destroyed. Bartolomeo is, like, frothing at the mouth because of how awesome Zoro is, and that's not actually an exaggeration. That is literally what's happened, because everyone else is commenting on what Zoro just did. Like, Sai's like, holy shit, he has fucking that much power, and he didn't enter the tournament, and fucking, he's a henchman to Luffy? Holy shit. And yeah, Bartolomeo's just like, oh, so awesome. Which is kind of what I was doing last week. So I guess in that way, maybe I want Bartolomeo to join the Straw Hats, because in a way it would almost be like, I'm joining the Straw Hats. Holy shit, I think I just added a whole new layer to my love of Bartolomeo. Oh, that's awesome. Anyway, we cut also to the Smile Factory, which is being exploded, because Tantata's like, fuck this shit, and fuck this thing, and blow that up! And we then see the, what are their names? Is it Leo? I guess it's Leo. Yeah, Leo. Leo and Mancherry. Leo and Mancherry show up where Kairos and everyone's hanging out. And Mancherry's like, let me heal you. You're terribly hurt. I want a different voice for her. Yeah, she's not going to talk a whole lot. I guess I don't need to. Kairos is like, no. I've heard about your powers, but there must be a limit to them. So don't use them on me. I'm fine, and I'm still conscious. And more importantly, you're safe. It must have been a terrible time. If you can use your powers to help, there are countless people in this land who need them. And you think back to, you know, that might not have a lot of impact right now, in this exact moment here, but if you actually think back, we have seen brief glimpses in previous chapters where we have seen that this birdcage has caused devastation to people. There were scenes of, you know, kids crying over their parents' bodies and things of that nature. So it actually does make sense that he's like, no, don't heal me. I'm fine. There are people out there who are actually going to need this. They basically come to the conclusion, they're like, you know, we're just going to have to, you know, leave our hope in the hands of a pirate crew. And everyone's like, ah, Luffy, Law, and, you know, all that. We then cut away to the interior of the palace, and Koala is there watching. I guess it looks like she might have been, I don't know who's down there. I guess those are just guards. I guess this isn't supposed to be any specific battle she's watching, but she's like, trying to free some of the straggling prisoners. That's Sabu who's saying, I'm freeing some of the straggling prisoners of the Colosseum. There's too much distance to reach you. And she's calling Sabu because she's like, I wouldn't be calling if this is in my power, but Luffy could be in serious trouble. And Sabu says, I'm on my way. She said, good grief, like Charlie Brown. Which makes me laugh, because now I think about like Charlie Brown, like, ugh. I'm just going to kind of skip that. Zoro and Usopp have a moment, and they note, they're like, okay, well, now that Pika's down, that means there's only three members of Doflamingo's family left. And Viola's like, no, it's only two. And we cut away to Luffy fighting against Bellamy, and we cut to the ending of this, actually, as we already see Bellamy's face implanted into the ground with a fish-shaped mark on it. And we kind of know, if you've read this series already, if you've been to the Gyar arc, you know what's happening. And I think it's actually kind of cool the way they set this up, because, again, you kind of already know what's about to happen. It's the same scene all over again. So we see the ending of it first, but then we flash back to what brought us to this, and Bellamy's springing around doing that his crazy high speed attack, and he's like, even if I die, as long as I take you with me, at least that might ensure that Doflamingo remembers me. Luffy screams out, there's no reason for you to risk your life for his sake. And then Bellamy's like, that's for me to decide. He punches Luffy. Holy shit, I get too excited about this series. And Bellamy's talking about, basically he goes on to kind of carry through more to the points he made before. And Luffy's explaining, he's like, he said he'd set you free, but you're just hoping to stay here and die fighting me. Don't you think he knew this would happen? And Bellamy's crying. He's like, I know it, so what? He has my complete and total respect, and dying is what it takes to win his approval, then I'll gladly do it. And Luffy and him have basically a war of words, like, you liar, you have no other choice. You're a man! Exactly, you should know to shut up and fight me, but you're wasting your life! And Bellamy's like, no, it is what I want. To have the end be at the hands of the only other man I've ever respected. If you're not going to take my fight seriously, then I'll keep going until I kill you. Take your stance, you coward! And as Bellamy comes in for his final attack, he says, thank you for calling me a friend. So long, Straw Hat! As we see, Luffy is infusing his hand with armament hockey, and then he delivers that same punch we saw back in Jaya, that punch right to the face that just sends him careening right to the ground. And Bellamy is losing consciousness on the ground. And as he's doing so, he thinks back and he says, I understand that I chose the wrong man to idolize. And we see a shot of Luffy looking up into where Doflamingo was before this. And he continues, and how pitiful that makes me. But if I'm going to be an idiot, I've got to see that choice through to the end. And Luffy screams out to Doflamingo, who we then cut to. And he says, I hear a wild beast howling. He better get up here soon. Or he'll be so surprised, Law, once he sees your dead body. I don't know why I made him the Joker. I felt like that was the most appropriate situation there. But this is a very cool chapter. The whole thing here, I mean, this is such like a manly, like just uber masculine, stupid logic to it of like, I made my commitment to this man. I made my bed, and I'm going to sleep in it, even though there's a much easier scenario out of here. But you have to. It's that same kind of mentality that comes in with a lot of One Piece and your ambitions and your dreams and sticking to them no matter what. And that's sort of what it came down to here. So I know there's some people who probably don't see a whole lot in this. They're probably like, whatever. But I took a lot out of it. I like Bellamy going to these lengths. He knows he's going to lose, and even if he doesn't, he knows he's going to die doing this, but he's just too proud to basically give up on the fact that he recognizes he chose the wrong person to admire. He's not just going to be like, all right, well, I fucked up, I'm going to switch sides right now, I'm going to see this through to the end. And Luffy has to essentially put him down. I know he doesn't kill him, and I think this is obviously going to be something that we're going to see. I imagine we're going to see Bellamy again at some point, but I think it's going to be really cool. I think that they're setting Bellamy up to eventually have like a real point where he comes in as an ally of some kind. Maybe not, maybe he doesn't, but I liked his mentality for this, and I thought it worked effectively. The twist at the end of like, oh, you're going to be surprised once you see his dead body. I mean, it's, hey, come on, I know Law's not dead. Don't even try to tease me with that. It's not going to do anything. I know he's not dead. The only thing that's interesting about that is I actually thought about this recently, and I was thinking how we know that the op-op fruit grants the power of immortality at the cost of the user's life or something like that. It costs someone's life to grant immortality. I don't know if the fruit user can kill someone else to make them immortal, I'm assuming not, but can grant immortality. And I'm assuming, you know, Law's dead body, even if he is dead for some reason, Mancheri can fix him back up. I'm not worried about him actually being dead, but I had the thought of the immortality, and I started thinking on if it isn't actually referring to a literal immortality. The notion of if it's actually referring to like a figurative immortality. Think like Force Ghosts from Star Wars. And the notion being, because we know that the Opop Fruit's powers were known of before this. That's why people were hunting down for it. So there's been a previous owner to it, and people know that that power exists. I'm wondering if maybe that doesn't have something to play with Gold Rogers. And maybe that's something that Gold Rogers has that immortality in his own way. Like maybe there's like a fucking Force Ghost of him somewhere out there. It's just a thought I had. Because I was trying to kind of reinterpret the whole immortality aspect of the Opop Fruit. But it was just an idea I thought of that I thought I'd throw out there. Come on, guys. Yeah, you gotta fucking give me something here. I'm throwing stuff out, seeing what sticks. Not everything's gonna work. Not all my theories are gold. I can't always predict Leonard Nimoy's going to die, you know? Anyway, let's move on to Toriko, chapter Gourmet 315. Times 240 trillion! Because if you didn't know, officially at this point, I'm done with Seven Deadly Sins. I'm just going to drop it out. We have too many series in the recap as it is, so not talking about it this week, or probably for a while, if ever again. So just, I don't think there's too many people who are upset about that. I imagine that was probably the point most people tuned in anyway. But Toriko this week was basically a battle chapter. And I'm not a crazy big fan of describing battle chapters in absurd detail, so this one's going to be pretty quick. Basically, everything falls apart. You know, they use their super attack, but it's not enough to defeat the Monkey King, so they all rip apart, and they start using their own special moves. You know, 40 trillion, or 240 trillion, you know, voice cutter, 240 trillion, mold spear dance, and somehow they're all throwing spears of super poison or whatever. They're all doing their special attacks, and, yeah, they managed to trick the Monkey King using a poison doll, and they all grab onto Pear, but they note that it's too strong. It's like they're giant spears that are part of the earth. The Monkey King does this really creepy thing where it's you know, because they're behind the Monkey King reaching under his legs to grab it, and the Monkey King grabs them all and then just, like, fucking turns its neck completely behind itself to try to bite at them. And it actually does. It rips, you know, chunks out of all of them. So Toriko decides to take his own attack into this and uses Jet Fork. But because they're not in sync, that makes the gravity affect them all over again. And basically, all bets are off at that point. Everyone starts using their special attacks and the gravity starts affecting them. You know, the Monkey King destroys the arena they were in. Coco uses double poison, which didn't do anything because Coco sucks. And all of a sudden, you know, blows up the arena. They start falling, and suddenly everyone starts crying. They're like, "What's happening? Don't tell me!" And they see that they're in a field of Sundoricos, basically that piranha plant-looking motherfucker who, may, you know, when it sprays when it sprays its pores, it makes you cry all the water out of you. And we see Bambina has shown up there, and it's crying. Basically, all of the four kings are helpless, so Bambina grabs them all, and it's slowly lifting them up into their mouths, and Toriko says, "Damn it, if you're gonna eat me, then I'll turn around and eat you right back!" Which is kind of awesome, in, like, that Toriko, this is so stupid, but that's somehow awesome manner. So Toriko actually does. He bites him, the Monkey King on his lips, and by doing so, it briefly takes all of them into the back channel. I'm not sure exactly how this works. I'm guessing maybe Pear has something to do with it. But we see that they're now in the back channel. And Toriko and them could see Komatsu is behind the Monkey King. And the Monkey King behind Komatsu, or behind the Four Kings, sees what seems to have been the dance partner that was alluded to in the other Monkey King dance things. And seeing this mate causes the Monkey King to cry. And Pear just plops right off of his body. And I guess they're going to make soup out of his nuts now. So that's Toriko. This isn't a bad chapter, Toriko. I should note that. It's just sort of a... I don't get the back channel part. And that's just because I haven't, like, fully comprehended it yet. I don't know. But this is a fine chapter. It was a battle chapter, so there's not a whole lot for me to speak on. So, anyways, let's move on to World Trigger. Or no, sorry, I fucked this up again. It's Ultra Battle Satellite, because U comes before W. And no matter what alphabet I'm trying to use. So, oh fuck. Ultra Battle Satellite, round two, now fight. Alright, so, Ultra Battle Satellite, you know, last time we saw the first chapter, Jin Matsumura is our protagonist for some reason, and he won his first street fight by beating up some dude, and he made a bunch of money, now he has a bounty for $7,000 on him, and he's like, I'm super awesome! And there's also this weird, creepy girl who, you know, looks like she's, like, into occult shit, and she's playing with the doll in class. And... Alright, so... Basically, we're introduced to... We cut his way to the classroom. Like, it's next day, we're in the classroom, you know, this creepy girl is doing voodoo on a doll, and she's weird and everything like that. And we cut away to Kazumi Kuroki, who is AK, the class's queen bee. And she says, like... Tale, and listen to my friend said, Momoji met Matsuyura at the shrine yesterday. What? I don't get it. Do you think she's a good match for him? And that's when, what's his name? I have it here. Jin shows up. I don't know why it's not our name, but I just don't care. Jin shows up and sees that I actually don't know what's happening here. Why are two people knocked out? I'm trying to... Did I miss a page? He walks in the room and there's two people knocked out. Or passed out. I guess they could also be passed out. Kind of looks like there's beer cans around one of them. But that's what he... But that's what he looks like fucking Jin stopping to be, like, shocked by. He didn't open it with the door and knock them out. Why the fuck are they knocked out? The hell is this? I'm so lost. Alright. So I got distracted by this. I don't know why. I just didn't notice it before. Anyway. Fuck. What's her name? I had it written down here. Kuroki. Kuroki asks, do you know what you're doing? I mean, y'all lose out on a ton of cred if you ask out that depressing nerd. You won't be as popular anymore. You know there are much cooler girls than her. Like, for example, May. And, Jin's like, what do you mean, cooler? You judge people by the way they look and act? That's just lame. What a floozy. Which is kind of, like, hypocritical. If you're just like, I don't know that you're actually, like, loose or, you know, flirty or anything like that, per se. But I'm just going to judge you based on... Hold on a second. You judge people based on the way they look and act. Like, I understand not judging people based on the way they look. But, like, judging someone by how they act is actually, like, a pretty valid way of judging somebody. I understand you can't judge somebody out based off one action, but I don't know why, like, rereading that quote in the sense of, like, it is pretty hypocritical of him to be acting this way. I just read it and was just like, wait, what's wrong with judging somebody with how they act? Isn't that what you're supposed to do? Maybe don't, you know, don't condemn them, but, I mean, generally speaking, you should judge somebody based off their actions and anything else. Anyway, fucking Jin punches her shirt open. I don't get what happens here. I really don't. He punches her in the stomach. Like, he just, like, kind of, like, flaps her fucking shirt. And then all of a sudden, her shirt explodes open. I guess he took all of her buttons off. Or he slapped her shirt so hard, her buttons exploded off of her shirt? Holy shit, I don't know what happens in this. He just fucking slaps her shirt and it explodes. Alright. He then notes you're more appealing to guys now, which is a pretty fucking sexist thing to say. But whatever, I guess that's Jin, he's an asshole. And his shitty friend's like, oh cool, I snuck a shot of her in her underwear, I'm gonna sell this for 10,000 yen. I'm like, alright, cool. Let's just get into that awful train of thought as well. Fucking... I don't know, I don't want to get into it. Holy shit, this series. Alright, so... I don't even want to get into the rest of this. This all sucks. Basically, the fucking creepy girl is, you know, talking to him about UBS, an Ultra Battle Satellite. And, you know, he notes how it's pretty interesting that you know about it. And she's like, okay, you know, if you want to talk more about it, why don't you meet me at the shrine? So they do so. And when she gets there, she reveals that she has her own satellite. And all of a sudden, it sends a message out that says a battle is starting. We see different glimpses around the world of all these various people who are either part of Ultra Battle Satellite or have paid an absurd amount of money to watch Ultra Battle Satellite. And they all look at their phone and they're like, a fight's on! And all of a sudden, Sakura leaps at him and starts kicking him in the face in this big two-page spread, and she flips away. And Jid's like, what are you doing? She's like, you were there yesterday. The fucking rules are there's no rules. When you start a match, it's fucking, you know, no rules, dickhead. She goes on to explain how the system itself works, how it's, you know, streamed worldwide. Anybody can get onto it as long as you'll pay. And I guess the annual fee is like $10,000 at its lowest rate. They basically say that people will bet on these matches. So various people around the world will see a match come up and they'll then wager money on top of it to kind of determine how this is. And it basically just cuts around to different various people being like, oh, I bet $5,000 on the Ninja Girl. Just various bullshit like that. They're all like ultra caricatures. Like, it's like, hold on, we got a guy fucking, you know, we got an Asian man who's going to be in the most stereotypical, like, it's like the perfect character. Like, here's a black guy with dreadlocks and a tattoo and a chain and he's surrounded by graffiti. Or, you know, here's what looks like an Indian guy and he's got, like, the headdress on and, you know, flower necklace and the fucking Taj Mahal's behind him. And, oh, hey, it's fucking Chun-Li from Street Fighter, you know, like, it's everybody's a caricature. Like, apparently, who uses Ultra Battle Satellite. But because of that, Jin's super greedy because he's like, I love money. And he decides to fight her. So a fight will happen between Jin and Sakura. He's worth 7,000. She's worth 12,500. And holy shit, that's a series. I guess I just skipped through it the past two times that I read this series. But holy shit, that was so much worse the third time through. Like, goddamn. It was so painful. I don't know why. It's just, ugh. Like, the stupid shit at the beginning didn't make sense. And the fact that he punched her shirt off or open, whatever, is dumb. But the rest of it was not interesting. I like this series in the sense that I think the action thus far has been well drawn. I hate the artwork otherwise, though. And the premise is ultimately just kind of like Street Fighter the manga. You know, it's not like as deep into Street Fighting is maybe like, eh, it's only been two chapters, so it's tough to tell. But, like, I don't want to think of it like a Street Fighting manga in the same way it would, like, Holy Land. Like, that was a whole different, you know, beast in and of itself. But this one, it was just, I don't know, like, it just feels like that's what you're trying to go for, like, Street Fighter. Let's just get a whole bunch of eclectic personalities, which presumably is what we're going to get into, and have them fight, and they beat each other up for money, you know. It seems like an okay premise. The art, when it comes to action, is fine, but everything else is awful. Like, I don't care about this lead, he's an asshole. I don't care about her, she's also just a weird asshole. The art for all the women, like, all the women in this series look like aliens who are trying to impersonate what a human looks like. They're, like, they're all just, like, and not well, like, they're all just fucked up looking. Like, they're vaguely human, which, like, you're not. What's wrong with you? Like, what's happened to you? Why do you look like this when all the dudes look fine? There's even, like, in this two-page spread with, you know, the various, you know, caricatures betting, there's one guy who's, of course, a creepy pervert who's betting all of his money on Sakura because she's a girl, and behind him is a poster of a woman in a bikini. That's how we know he's a creepy pervert. Even that little girl, like, that girl right there has such weird fucked-up eyes and a, like fucking blush mark. Like, it's just like, what is this? Why do women in this series look so they're so fucked up? I don't get it. I don't get Ultra Battle Satellite. I was much more positive going into this chapter than I actually ended up being. I don't know how this happened, but wow. Alright, whatever. I'm not going to get into it. Let's finish this up. Let's go into World Trigger, because I want to finish off on something good. So World Trigger, chapter 95, Susanati 1. Hold on, I gotta wash down. I should have brought booze. Holy shit. Work through that. Alright, let's do this. So, we start off with a flashback to Ko about 8 months ago. And he's super depressed. he's like sitting in a corner crying, and all of his teammates are like, you know, what happened to him? And you know, they noted that he's already, you know, he's sad because Erafune quit suddenly being an attacker. And his sniper friend's just like, well, that's because Kill surpassed him already. Maybe Erafune just realized he has no talent. I just gave Peter Griffin's voice or something. I don't know. I'm working off of fumes, guys. All right. And the operator punches that guy in the face because she's like, you're just making it worse. And Ko explains that that's, you know, it's always been like this. This has always been his fate in life because of his side effect. I get people to teach me things, but just when it starts to get fun because he's good enough to compete with them, he surpasses them because he's learned everything they have. And everyone who was there starts to fade away because they don't want to play with him anymore because he's just going to beat them. He's just going to be better than them. He's going to learn everything they can teach him and then get better, and they can't keep up with that. That's what his side effect does. And because of that, the group dynamic falls apart. And, you know, he notes that Erafune only taught me his master theory on attackers. There's so much more I need to learn from him, but I just steal everyone's work with my side effect. That's all it's doing. And he starts, you know, crying about that. And that's actually a fucking, like, this is what I love about World Trigger. It's taken this character, who's like a side guy right now, and it's in one, what is this, two pages right here? Two pages and, like, a little bit at the third page? Has made him interesting. Like, I mean, he was interesting before, but he's more interesting now because you've added another layer into the side effect. It doesn't just make him an uber badass, it's also been something that's been ostracizing him for, you know, presumably, it looks like since he was a child. Or at least for several years, he's like, because of my side effect, I'm constantly surpassing everyone else I'm around, and because of that, they don't want to hang out with me anymore. They don't want to be around me because I'm going to be better than them. And that's a fucking interesting angle to take with this, you know? Like, that's a cool aspect. It turned what seemed like a super awesome power, and he's like, nah, there's a downside to it, and it kind of bums me out. And I relate to you, man. I get bummed out by things a lot too, Ko. I'm supporting you. But not against Usamu. You were fucked by going into this match against Usamu. I'm sorry. It is what it is. But anyways, we're still in the flashback. And I forget the guy's name, unfortunately. The guy with the white hair in Susanari 1. I believe that's the gunner of the group, the captain. I'm sorry. I didn't write his name down because I'm bad. But he actually goes to Erafune. And Erafune's like, what? No, that idiot's overthinking it. I already planned to quit when I got 8,000 points, but I just didn't want to tell anyone about it because it sounds like an excuse. And he explains, you know, my plan is not to become the best attacker or anything like that. I want to prove that I can get to master class with my methods, and my next goal is to get 8,000 points as a sniper. Then after that, I'll become a gunner, and then I'll be a perfect all-rounder. And at that point, I'll use my methods to teach everybody this, and produce all effective, or mass-produce perfect all-rounders. And that's when we actually see, where is it? Again, I don't know his name. White-haired guy is like, oh, that's really ambitious. So Erafune is like, I'll teach Ko again, but after I reach my goal. Basically, he wants to reach his own ambitions for himself, and then he'll teach Ko how to be the Kobos. But to keep Ko in good spirits, he gives him a call, and he says, hey, Ko, sounds to me... Hold on, maybe I should make this guy a wacky voice. Alright, Erafune, you're Terrence Howard. Hey there, Ko, sounds to me like you're drunk on your own power. You think just because you beat me, you're now king of the world? Sorry. My Terrence Howard's awful, but I'm sick. I just want to use it. Alright, he's like, you're stealing everyone's hard work. My teaching skills are just that good. It sounds more like Cat Williams than fucking Terrence Howard. Let's just pretend it's a Cat Williams one, but then at the start, no. Then you get into bad language and all that. Anyways, he's just like, don't be so full of yourself. That crap, you should save it until after you've beaten Tachikawa, Kazama, and Kage, alright? And that seems to lift Ko's spirits. At that point, Ko actually wakes up from it, and everyone's like, are you done with your review? And he's like, yeah, I'm ready. And he starts heading out for this. Sean Connery. No, I should have done it with Sean Connery. Oh, well. We then cut away to Tamakoma. And Osamu's going over their strategy. He notes that there are three likely squads for Naso Squad to choose. And he's going over the various ones. He basically figures that they're probably going to aim for a mid-range fight because of that fight that Suzunari 1 lost to Suba Squad. And now that was the strategy they did with them. They kept Ko at range and used that to wear them down and get the victory. And because that worked against them before, it's likely to not only work against them then, but should also work against Tomokoma 2 because they have a very similar setup. So he presumes that that's what NASA Squad's probably going to do. And this time, they're going to be the ones on the reacting side of things, so they need to fight together as much as possible. So their plan, when they get into the arena, is to first meet up overall. And they all say yes. And then we cut away to NASU Squad, and we see NASU Squad, who are all in their uniforms as well. And this is interesting, because we've seen, you know, different teams have different uniforms, but this is the first one that actually looks like armor. It's got a strange look to it. It almost looks like plastic armor, like flexible plastic of some kind. But there's one thing I don't get. All of them, you know, it's an all-girl squad. They have this armor, but there's one like little strap on the inside of their armor. I don't know what it's supposed to be. And because it's an all-girl squad, I can't help but think all of them just have one bra strap showing, which I'm sure isn't the point. But I don't get what else that strap is there for. I like the costume. It's different. It's weird, but in a good way. I don't get that strap. It's bothering me. Like, I keep being like, girl, you gotta adjust your, you know, shit's showing. You know, just fucking pull your fucking plastic shoulder up over it. Anyway, they actually have a plan. NASU Squad is planning to use the riverbank stage. And their goal is to try to split up all the other squads because, you know, it's a riverbank, there's a huge river, but city's on the other side. They're going to get split up. They're like, look, we're going to play a little bit of luck in this, but we're hoping that what's going to happen is we're going to meet up, we'll destroy the bridge, and this will keep everyone, the other two squads, separated. And then we'll use the riverbanks to our advantage to keep them there. And we cut over to Akane, Hira? I don't know. Akane. And Akane basically says, I'm going to handle this from my side. Don't worry, I got it covered because I'm awesome. It actually does look kind of cool. I don't know why. People were saying I pooped all over her last week. I don't feel like I pooped all over her. I just said snipers for some reason all wear wacky hats. It's very strange. I'm just waiting for next week when it's like a dude with like the next sniper shows up and he's like, my name is Ricardo and I wear an enormous sombrero because it's just what snipers do. We just all wear very funny hats. But I think she looks cool. Anyway, I dig her. Anyway, I have a secret crush on her. Don't tell her. I want to make sure I make a good first impression, all right? You can't lose out on a girl like this. A fictional girl who's 12 years my junior. Okay, anyway, the team basically says, NASU rather says, cover me, Akane. Akane says, you know, leave it to me, and she basically gives promises to them, like, if you guys cover me, I promise that I'll get the points. We then cut away to the actual studio, and for the commentary this week, we have, or this game, whatever, Tachikawa and Jin are going to be doing this, and in unison they say, thanks for having us, which is kind of creepy. They just nailed it perfectly. And they find out we have picked Riverbank A, as we knew. And the commentator Mikame from Kazama. So, why did I not know that? Anyway, Mikame asks, you know, Tachikawa, give your insight. And he's like, I can't joke. She's like, no jokes. Oh, all right. To hold off the attackers, they'll take out the bridge. And using the river, all shooter NASU squad will be hard to take down. But Suzunari and Tomokoma already know that. The topography, the map thing alone won't decide this match. The river is only waist deep. With cover fire, it's not impossible to cross the river. And Jin's like, we'll see. He's like, oh, did you see something? He's like, I just said we'll see. When did you get about that? And we enter into teams. Everyone enters into the match. And suddenly they see, it's raining outside. What the fuck? That's not cool. It is. It's raining. It's actually heavily raining. Like it's a gale, a storm, whatever synonym you want to use for really bad fucked up rain. And all the agents are in place, but as we see, everyone who's not a part of Nasty Squad is stunned by this. They were not expecting these weather conditions. And Mizumi notes, he's like, it's the weather conditions are rainstorm. And the commentators explain that when you get to pick the stage, you can also select the time of day and the weather. And Jin also notes he's never seen such an extreme situation, so Nasty Squad must be taking this very seriously. And we see a map of the field where all the squads have been split up on each side of the river. And we see that Ko and Yuma are on the same same side as Akane and the shooter. I forget her name, unfortunately. I'm blanking on names this week. They're on one side. Everyone else is on the other. So that means it's two of NASA's squad with the two big attackers from the other team. And then everyone else on the other side. But Nasty Squad, obviously, because they knew of this condition, they're prepared. They might have a lead because they're not surprised. So they're like, everyone, let's get started. And they all give a command of Roger as they head out. And that's World Trigger this week. And I really like this chapter. I mean, you know, you could almost like can a response to me from last week. Like you hit a button and it's just like, this chapter of World Trigger was great because I love this series. And then it's just a shot of me like going down on like a figurative fucking like the metaphorical cock of World Trigger, like oh. But it is true. I love this series. I thought this was another really good chapter this week. I love that we got a whole bunch of different insights into these teams. You know, I love seeing more stuff about Ko that makes him a more compelling character. I like seeing a little bit of Naso. I note that she may not be like Nasu Squad's kind of like the other team in this, but I feel like you can't sleep on them. Like, I feel like they're going to give them something. So maybe they might not be the more important team in this matchup. Like, I think Ko's going to be the ultimate one in this, but I thought this was very cool. Like, I like what we're getting from her. I think we're going to get some more of her. I'm hoping to see what that team actually does. I'm hoping to see all these different guys, because last time it was Tamakoma Squad going up against two teams better than they were. Now they're going up against two teams lower than they were and two teams that are gunning for them. So I really want to see how this one goes. I'm super excited for next week, and I'm super glad we have one next week, because I didn't mention it before, but we have no One Piece next week, which is a pretty big bummer. And it's kind of disappointing. But we'll survive. We will survive. And speaking of surviving, that's it. That's Weekly Manga Recap this week, guys. I apologize. Once again, it was a solo episode, so Maybe not as full as much yucks as a normal episode is. 15 minutes talking about, the Hulk jerking off or anything like that. But hopefully you guys managed to get a couple laughs out of this. I don't have the actual list of things that Nick normally brings up, so I'm kind of going off of pure memory here. But guys, Weekly Manga Recap, we record here every Wednesday evening, twitch.tv/royalty at 7 p.m. Eastern. Episodes go up on That Guy with the Glasses the next day, and then usually on Friday you will see Weekly Manga Recap going up on iTunes. You can find it there on iTunes, and you can also find it at podbean.com, weeklymangarecap.podbean.com. One second. While I'm here, let me just see if anyone has given us any other 5-star reviews on iTunes, because we greatly appreciate it, and I want to give a shout-out to them. I don't believe so. It looks like we're at the same as before. But anyway, guys, if you ever get the chance... Oh, no, we did get one. Did we? Hold on. When was the 6th? I think so. Yeah, we did. So, no, we did get one from Calumny47. So thank you, Calumny47. We also want to give a shout-out to The Infamous Planet, who does visual editions of episodes. He probably won't do one of this one, because he's like, well, this is awful. And he's also too busy getting his ass spanked by me in Trivia Crack. But give special thanks to him. You can check out his channel at youtube.com/TheInfamousPlant. And of course, I also give another special thanks to our title card artist, Steve Mann. You can find his work out at neuroticfanboy.deviantart.com and idrawboobs.tumblr.com, as well as his Patreon, patreon.com/SteveMann. I think that's it. Oh, guys, and of course, if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, recommendations, anything else like that, you can send those all in to our email, weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. All right. I think that's it, guys. I think we're good. I know with all the Jumpstart series, it should have been a 5-hour-long podcast. I just couldn't. I couldn't hold on to it that long. I tried to, guys. I really thought that Terrence Howard would hold me for about another 5 minutes. But it just didn't come to pass. But hopefully, everyone still enjoyed this episode. Next week, we'll have Nick back. I don't know what to end on. I don't know what to improv in as our final wacky joke to end the episode off with. I guess Alabama puppy fart, everybody. And remember, don't tip the waiter. Hail Hydra. Bye.